It's February 22nd, the first of the Shulim on Chatayehem Shal Rishoni, the sins of the firstborn elders. Chatayehem Shal Ketohi Olam, sins of the great of the world. I'm going to take you through, in the text, what the Tesla does here is to take some ideas that are quite familiar, and other ideas that are not so familiar, and he enforces them in, as a way of reading verses and incidents in the Tanakh. And if you keep it in mind, it can save you from a lot of wasted effort in trying to understand things that take place in the Tanakh. So he starts. When we hear that a person has performed a crime, avla, we cannot know at all what level the severity of the crime is intended. When the report is he performed an avla, it's impossible for us to know, just from the bare words he did an avla, what the severity of the crime is that was committed. Unless we also know the character of the person of whom it's being said and his moral level. Because the value of a crime depends upon the type of character that the person has who is describing the crime. We're talking now about the character of the person speaking the words. He said, so-and-so did, and I don't know how to say that, Yiddish word. It means crime, but with a kind of, it expresses almost disgust. You know, it's like, putting an ablis where you have a small moral revulsion to what the person has done. For example, Rav Safra in Gemara for him committing an avla includes not speaking the truth in your heart, meaning you think something in your heart, you make up your mind to do something, you don't carry it out, that's already a crime. Or someone repeats over an idea and doesn't say it in the name of the person who told it to him. Now, for most people, if I make up my mind to do something in my heart, I don't tell anybody, it's perfectly okay to change my mind. I didn't promise anybody anything. Here's a case where to most people, this is regarded as perfectly permissible, normal behavior. For our soccer, it's a terrible crime. I think of information. I'm an active person. I read a lot. I talk to people. I hear things. Am I required to remember the source of every piece of information I pick up? And now that's remembered, but to repeat that, I heard this from him, I heard that from him, I heard that from him. Most people don't regard that as their responsibility. It's normal to hear things and to get where they come from. So Sefton, he quotes here, says that this is an aspect of theft. Not everybody would regard it as such. So now, if a Safra says that a crime has been committed, or the author of the Tosefta says a crime has been committed, he may be talking about something which to the rest of us isn't a crime at all. To us it's just trivial or normal behavior. So in order to understand what's meant when someone says a crime has been committed, you have to know the standard of the person who's speaking. There are those who think, on the contrary, that fraud, misleading your competitor, withholding information is perfectly all right. That's normal business competition. Industrial espionage. No. Get yourself better safeguards if you don't want me to steal your information. There you go, that is perfectly normal. So what would he mean when he says somebody committed a great crime? Maybe took a submachine gun and blew up people on the street. How far would you have to go for him to be impressed and morally revolted by an action? Whereas, because his standards of what's normal are so low. There are people who steal, and for whom stealing is perfectly normal, acceptable behavior. If that sounds extravagant to you, my wife had a book many years ago called The Professional Thief. It was an in-depth interview with a guy in the penitentiary. And his philosophy was, everybody steals. The white-collar businessman, you know, works for IBM, uses his telephone to call his girlfriend in Alaska, and the taxi driver doesn't print the receipts for you so you can cheat the government. Everybody's stealing. Obviously, by people's behavior, you see that stealing is regarded as normal. Okay, I pick people's pockets. So what? You know, stock manipulation and all the rest of it. The only difference between them and me, said this guy, is that I'm honest. I tell the truth. And I'm pretty prepared to admit it. Everybody else is stealing and pretending you're not stealing. No, I don't do. I'm willing to say it up. So here's a person whose standards are that low. When he says a crime has been committed, he's going to be talking about murder. He's not going to be talking about theft. So the expression that a crime has been committed is relative to the standards of the person who's making the statement. Now, what happens when the Torah says a crime has been committed? How are we supposed to interpret that? What kind of standard would the Torah use when it expresses the phrase of a crime being committed? We expect it to be the highest of the evaluations, he says. He refers to another essay that he wrote. God says through Isaiah the prophet in chapter 55, my thoughts are not your thoughts, and your ways are not my ways, says Hashem. Just as high as the heavens are above the earth, so my ways are, my thoughts are above yours. So if the Torah is going to express God's evaluation, we have to be aware, we have to be careful not to read God's word that he reveals to us as we would take them from the New York Times or Time Magazine or some other more common source. Therefore, he says, it's understood that when the Torah describes what it calls crimes, the analysis is extremely fine, extremely detailed, like a microscopic analysis. Even microscopic is not careful enough to express the precision and penetration of the Torah's analysis. For example, the Torah says when Moses hit the rock, God said to Moses, speak to the rock. Moses hit the rock. The immediate response, God says to him, Yan lo hemanti bi, lash b'shem v'eni b'nei Yisrael, says to Moses and Aaron, because you didn't ma'ami in me to sanctify me, you're not going to bring the Jewish people into the land of Israel. Now, la'ami is usually translated as to believe. Of course, I take that literally and the way we talk. Because you didn't believe in me, therefore. So what are you supposed to think? That Moses and Aaron became atheists for a little bit? Maybe they listen to God. You know? Maybe the universe is really accidental. Maybe all the voices we heard are just dreams. And that's insane. But on the other hand, the word is, you didn't believe in me. So what you have to understand is that the Torah is describing a lack of belief in Moses. And yet, but the Torah is penetrating to an extremely fine, extremely narrow, extremely tiny detail of Moses' performance, which from the Torah's point of view is a lack of belief. And one proof of it is the commentators struggle to figure out what exactly Moses' crime was. Not easy to figure out on the spot what the crime is. If Avinel counts 10 different interpretations of what the crime was, and he has objections against all of them, and then he breaks an 11th analysis, which means that the Torah does not make a clear statement of what the crime was. Now, you know, we read that little paragraph. God says to speak, and Moses hits the rock and says, "Because you didn't believe in me." But it doesn't say, "Because you didn't believe in me and you hit the rock." It just says, "Because you didn't believe in me." So one has to look for some kind of proof. What in the description of the event is the failure? And indeed, for example, some of them say that it wasn't the pressure he threw out, but the speech didn't make. Shimuna Hamori, listen now, you rebels. Who told them to call them rebels? Maybe that's the crime. Or maybe something else. And what we have out here is an illustration of a Talmudic statement. In Sivat Kehut Asaira, God is exacting. Very exactly in simple language. He criticizes and calls to account those who are close to him to a hair's breadth.
To a
hair's breadth. To the breadth of a hair. Now that already means that's only for them. God has a sliding scale. He doesn't evaluate everyone in the same way. Which, if you think about it, is just plain morality. Obviously, you can't expect two people from different backgrounds, different talents, different education, different family upbringing to behave in the same way. And what for one person will be a terrible crime, for somebody else will be all you can expect from them. You can't expect any better. So when the Torah is talking about someone like Moses and it uses the language of crime, we have to appreciate what the language means. Just like you hear of Safra criticizing another one of his colleagues, one of the great Rabbona of the time, and said he committed a crime. It probably wasn't armed robbery. You know, it probably wasn't burning down his neighbor's house. Talking about Rav Safra, for whom making up your mind to do something and not carrying it out is a crime, so it's something like that. Because in his mouth, like to these people, that's what counts as a crime. Here, when the Torah describes the crimes of the greats of the world, you have to appreciate where the statement is coming from. This too you need to know. The language that the Torah uses to describe the sins of the great is according to its own evaluation, according to its level of evaluation. So that the Torah will use a word which has a meaning to us, and the Torah doesn't intend that meaning. When the Torah says thief, it could very well mean what the Safra calls a thief. Or the Torah, the Safra called a thief. You said over something without saying the source of where you heard it. So that we have to be very careful. Now, let me try to explain what this means in philosophical terms. We're not saying you can't trust the language of the Torah. The Torah is not always literal. You have to understand the Torah, and sometimes and figuratively, that's not what's being said. That's not what's being said. What's being said is the literal meaning of the word in this context is different from what you think. He made a big profit. Are we talking about the CEO of General Motors? Or talking about your 10-year-old child who set up a lemonade stand in the summer to sell lemonade to people who are passing by? Now, if I say, I'm talking about my 10-year-old, then he made $25 profit in 2 days. That's not taking the phrase big profit and giving it another meaning, a poetical meaning, and so forth and so on. When you're talking about a 10-year-old's lemonade stand, $25 is a big profit. When you're talking about the CEO of General Motors, so then it's $2 million is a big profit. Is that that the words change their meaning? Is that the meaning of the word depends upon the context in which it's used? It depends upon who's talking. He made a terrible mistake.
Who?
Einstein. Because he got 96 on the exam instead of 105. Instead of somebody else, that wouldn't be a big mistake. And he passed it on the context in which he was using it. So when the Torah uses words that describe crimes, and we say it was a very ethereal, very tiny, very subtle matter, someone says, what do you mean? It says theft. It says murder. It says adultery. We're not taking the words out of the normal meanings. What we're saying is, in this context, this speaker applied to this subject, the word has a meaning, has this meaning. It's a literal meaning in this context. He won by a large margin. If you're talking about the 100-yard dash, a large margin can be half a second. If you're talking about the marathon, a large margin it better be 3 or 4 minutes at least. We're not playing with the word, and it's not a metaphorical or fanciful meaning. Large margin in the 100-yard dash is one thing, and large margin in the marathon is something else. There is something else.
Here's one for the future, another talk. 3 hairs on your head is not a lot. 3 hairs in your soup, that's a lot.
good. 3 hairs in your head is not a lot. 3 hairs in your soup is a lot. Quite right. There's even the source of these paragraphs. Yeah, okay, that's something else. All right. So now, he says, I'll give you an explicit example of this. The incident with Achan. Now, when Joshua attacked Jericho, and of course, what he did is several of the 7 days, and the walls fell down. He made a pronouncement. No one should benefit from the booty of Jericho. None of it is going to be for our profit. We're not taking any. That is the law. Now, the Tanakh says, the book of Joshua says, God said to Joshua, Chata Yisrael, the Jewish nation, Jewish people, has sinned. And they violated my covenant, and the verb is plural. Avru is prisi. They violated my covenant. And they took from the forbidden material. And they stole. And they lied. And they hid it. And all the verbs are plural. There's forbidden material in your midst, O Israel. And you're not going to be able to fight the rest of your battles until you remove that forbidden material from your midst. Now, if I read these words with the dictionary, and without taking the context into account, Chata Yisrael, Israel sinned. Now, maybe that's not every man, last man, woman, and child. I would normally assume it's 50%. You're condemning the whole nation. So maybe, at least 50%. If it was a minority, why would you say the nation sinned? You say some Jews sinned. No, Chata Yisrael. And then all the verbs are plural. But what happened actually was only one person. Only Achan. He was the only person to steal from the chair. And we know that because of how it was subsequently resolved. Joshua said to God, who's guilty? God said, I'm not going to tell you directly. Perform the following test. And the test was performed, and Achan was the only person identified, and he was punished, and they went to the next battle, and they were successful. So it's absolutely clear from the text that Achan was the only one who violated the ban. Nevertheless, the Tanakh uses phraseology, which, if you're not aware of who the speaker is and the standards of the speaker, you would get a completely wrong impression as to the extent of the crime. If we wouldn't know how the event leads to play, surely we would have thought that if not the whole of the Jewish people, at least the majority sin, or at least some large representative portion of the people, 30%, 20%. But in actuality, says with us what happened, the Torah, the Tanakh, informs us that only one person did. And even so, we call Kal Yisrael. From the whole of the Jewish community, only one person took from the ban material. How could that be reconciled with the phrase Chata Yisrael? Israel has sinned, and they have stolen, and they have lied, and they have hidden. What you have to understand now, let's not make a mistake here. We're not saying, well, you see, that's the way it goes. It's an exaggeration. It's one person and he's called Israel. That's already absurd. That's already absurd. If it says Israel, it's got to be everybody. Or the majority. It's got to be. So it means that when it says that Israel sinned and stole and everything else, it means they're implicated in the crime. They're implicated in the crime. They have some kind of connection to the crime, which in the Torah's vocabulary could be called stealing and lying and violating the ban, even though in actual physical terms they didn't do that. We have to search for their sin in the recesses of the heart, the slivers of consciousness in the heart, according to their level. And you see how the analysis goes. In this particular case of Achan, what's revealed is a subtle lack in their in the connection of the Jewish people with God. Because we all know the great impact that community standards have on the behavior of the individual. What the Tanakh is telling us is that if the community standards had been higher in their connection to God and in their rejection of any illicit behavior, he never would have been able to do it. And this failure, the failure of intensity and consistency of community standards, justifies the language of the Tanakh, which says they all stole, and they all cheated, and they all lied, and they all hid it, and they all broke the covenant, even though in physical terms only one man did it. Now, let me just make this a little real to you. He stole gold, silver, and clothes, and he hid them. What was he going to do with them?
Come back and get it later.
Good. And what was he going to do then? Buy stuff with it? What about the clothes? The bathrobe with the Jericho cut. The Jericho style. Is he going to use them? Is his family going to become aware of this? Will they turn him in? They won't turn him in? Will the neighbors notice when he buys a 2007 Jaguar? Hi, Achan! You're the shoemaker. Where did you get the money for that? Ah, it came in the mail. He's counting on the fact that people will look the other way. They'll look the other way. They won't hold him to account. Imagine if he thought, if anybody found out, they would just ostracize him. No one would ever talk to him. No one would ever count him again. They wouldn't marry his children. You know, they'd throw him out of the community. He wouldn't risk it. How do I know? I'll prove it to you. Look at how social pressure works even today. In the Haredi world, there are either 0 or 0.00001% of Haredi women who smoke. I suppose you could find maybe 6 out of 1 million who smoke in private when nobody's looking. It's just not done. The men smoke, which is a terrible situation. Totally inappropriate. The men smoke and the women don't. What's the difference? The same population, the same religion, the same believers, the same literature. There's a social rejection of women smoking. And it works extremely well. And there's no social rejection of men smoking. So too bad. There should be. I wish there were. Shouldn't. Same thing's true with alcoholism. Are there Jewish alcoholics? Yes. Are there Haredi alcoholics? Yes. But the percentage is vanishingly small. It's very, very small. As opposed to the general population, it's extremely small. Why? Because it's not acceptable. It's just not acceptable.
World, it's not either.
What?
In the outside world,
you don't know what you're talking about. I grew up in that world. Let me tell you something. In the outside world, people brag about getting drunk. And each one brags that he drank more than the other guy and did more crazy things when he was drunk.
Not about being an alcoholic.
If you brag about you drinking, if you brag about and getting drunk, then people will become alcoholics. They'll become it because drinking and getting drunk is socially praiseworthy behavior. Whereas in our case, getting drunk is awful. It's just awful. You wouldn't even look at such a person. He couldn't tell anybody, oh, you should have seen me last night. Boy, was I drunk. Can't do that. You can't do that. No one will look at you. The social pressure is terrific. Now, the deficit. How did Achim think he was going to get away with this? Because he counted on the fact that if people heard about it, that they would, had there been a stronger connection to Kadosh Baruch Hu, commitment to Torah, and revulsion for failure, he never would have been able to do it. That failure of moral tone, we could call it, of moral tone and moral focus, is described in the words of the Tanakh. They stole, they lied, they cheated, they broke the covenant, when in physical terms they didn't do anything. Only one man did. So you have to know how to read it. You have to know how to read it. And again, this is not figurative use. It's not figurative use. No, I won't quote it. It was the president who said something similar. I got roasted for it. But anyway, the same thing is true which you find in the Golden Calf. What does God say to Moses? When Moses is on the mountain, he says to him, go down, because Shiches Amcha, your nation has behaved destructively. And it says, they made a molten calf, and they bowed to it, and they offered sacrifices to it, and they said, this is what took you out of Egypt. Now, if you read that verse straight through, the two verses, if you read those verses straight through, you would have the impression that the whole of the Jewish people were involved in the Golden Calf. Or at least a very sizable percentage, because it just says, Amcha, your people. Doesn't make any distinctions at all. Still, what happens at the end of the incident? Moses says to the Levites, so he executes the criminals, and about 3,000 men are killed. That's about 3,000 men out of 600,000 men, together with 600,000 women, of whom there were no criminals. So only male criminals, no female criminals. So from the words, Shiches Amcha, you end up with an extremely small percentage of actual criminals. And even so, in the words that are spoken, you find a description which sounds like they all deserve to be destroyed. But here too, we're talking about an analysis in the tiny, subtle details of belief and performance, not in gross idol worship. In gross idol worship, the percentage was vanishingly small. If you look at Ebenezer and Ramban and others, you see that what they really wanted was a substitute link for Moses. I've always shared this, you can get it on the website. And they wanted it only to connect with God because they thought that Moses was gone. As HaKadosh Baruch Hu, from time to time, did himself give them a link with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, like the copper snake, so as to focus their connection and attention to him. Only the Erev Rav, the mixed multitude of others, they wanted an idol. And that's why they were killed. But according to their level, according to the level of the Jewish people, having just 40 days before heard the revelation of Sinai, and having gone to all the places we need, and having witnessed the crossing of the sea, for them to fall into even wanting a substitute for Moses and inventing it, for them on their level, described from the point of view of the Torah, that could be called idol worship, avodah zarah, Let me just explain. Avodah Zarah strictly means strange service. Strange service. It means service that's not appropriate. Usually, it means service of something that's not appropriate. It refers usually to idol worship. It's service, the kind of service that's really relevant to God, and it's addressed to something else. Here, it's creating a link with God that you weren't commanded to do, created it on your own. So, you are using an item to focus your service, service of God, for sure, not service of the idol. But it's a wrong item. It's a wrong link. On their level, that could be called a Avodah Zarah. Not in strict legal terms, but describing the failure vis-a-vis what could be expected of them, that's called a Avodah Zarah. From this you have an explanation of what Chazal say when you have the misonanim, the people who complain, and the Torah says, "Vayi'am kemisonim." Literally means it, the people were as complainers. The Torah records their complaint and it records how they were punished. Why say it was as they were complaining? So Chazal say, "Mimeihem lochatu chaytugom." The Jewish people coming out of Egypt never committed a complete crime. They didn't get a complete punishment. Now, he's going to apply this to a statement which is very widely quoted and often misunderstood. Chazal said, anyone who says that Reuben sinned, the children of Eli sinned, who comes from these stories in the Tashem, the children of Shmuel sinned, David sinned, Solomon sinned, is making a mistake. Anyone who says that these people sinned is making a mistake. Now, don't misunderstand. This is not a whitewash. This is not a whitewash. After all, the Tanakh describes their failures. It describes their sins. It describes the punishment they got for their sins. It can't mean they didn't sin. So many people will quote it this way and will tell you, you see, if you think they sinned, you're wrong, you're not pious enough to understand that they really didn't sin. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. Especially those who got punished for it. And they didn't sin and they got punished. No, this is what Odessa says. It means someone who tells you that they sin according to the speaker's evaluation of what a sin is, he's making a mistake. If he applies his own standards to them and describes what they did as a sin, then he's making a mistake. It's not that they didn't sin, but the sin is described in the language of the Tanakh, from the point of view of the Tanakh, from the level of evaluation of the Tanakh, as applied to very great people. And in that respect, you have to know how to read what the words say. And not take them as if they were describing your next door neighbor written in the New York Times. The words don't have the same meaning under those conditions. And that's why you very often find that when the Tanakh describes a crime, and Chazal say, it didn't happen the way you think. You can't take the word as if they're written about your next door neighbor. That's the understanding. Who's writing it and who's being written about? And they give you another description and you say, oh my goodness gracious, that's not what the words say, and it looks like they're just trying to whitewash. It's neither of those things. It's understanding the source of the statement and the object to which it's applied. Take, for example, Reuben. What does the Torah say? The Torah says that Reuben had relations with his father's pilate, his father's kindness. What does Chazal say? Anybody who says that he had relations, which is a kind of pseudo-adultery, I mean, these women were taken by Yaakov as to wife, sort of, this is on the borderline of adultery. If it's not real adultery. No, say Chazal, that's not what happened. What happened was that Reuben sought to protect the honor of his mother. What happened? What really happened was this. Yaakov had two wives, Rachel and Leah. He preferred Rachel. He wanted to marry Rachel. Leah was inserted only through subterfuge. Then Rachel didn't have children, so he took, she said he should take her handmaid to wife. Leah stopped having children, she said, her handmaid to wife. So it ended up that Yaakov was living with four women. But his main residence was Rachel, because that Rachel was the one whom he was committed to. Rachel died. Now what? Now he put his main residence together with Rachel's maidservant. So at this point, Reuben, who's Leah's firstborn, said, listen, all as long as Rachel was alive, I understand history, I understand you preferred Rachel. It's natural enough. But now, you're going to take up with the maidservant instead of my mother, who's the sister? That's not right. That's not right. So what happened? When Yaakov was out in the field, Reuben took his father's furniture, his father's accoutrements, and moved them from the maidservant's tent to Leah's tent. That's what he did. That's what Chazal said.
That's going to stop his father?
It's a public demonstration of the feeling of the firstborn of Leah that what he's doing is wrong. Will it stop it? Who knows? You know, but you don't have to be guaranteed that something will work in order to do it. Surgery isn't guaranteed either. It doesn't mean people don't do it. That's what he did. So now, how could the Torah say that he had relations with this woman when what he did was move the furniture around? The answer is this. Reuben is taking a stand against his father's marital relations, against his father's marital policy. Okay, he's doing it by moving furniture around. But he's interfering with his father's marital relations. For someone on Reuben's level, how can we describe the seriousness of the crime? Indeed, had the Torah written what I just told you, had the Torah written what the oral tradition preserved, you wouldn't have known it was a crime at all. In fact, I must tell you, I'm very sympathetic to Reuben. I don't understand why Yaakov did what he did, and it was my mother. I think, you know, how come he's slighting my mother like that? You know, it's not right. We are so gross, we're so low, we're so insensitive, that we wouldn't regard what he did as a crime at all. We think it was perfectly all right. So the Torah to communicate to us. Reuben committed a terrible obligation. He committed a terrible crime. How is the Torah going to communicate to us the seriousness of the crime? It's going to speak to us in language which we understand and which really applies to him. Once you understand who he is, once you understand the standard up to which he's held, it's like Rav Safra's description that making up my mind in my heart to do something and not carrying it out is theft. The kind of theft. The case was somebody came in and asked him to buy something he couldn't interrupt, and the guy kept raising the price, and then when he could speak to him, he said, I'll sell it to you for the first price. And the other guy said, what do you mean? I already showed you I was willing to pay a higher price. He said, oh, when you said the first price, I already made up my mind to sell it to you. So I can't take the higher price, even though he's willing to give it, because that would be theft. No businessman today would behave like that. Came out on the telephone, didn't know what to tell us. $100? $200? $500? Let me buy $100. Sell me the thing. He said, I'm only taking $100 because when you first said $100, I was already green. Right? No one would do that. In fact, they ranked you out if you did that. He said, hey, it's stupid. You can wait for $100. Not for a stop. Huh?
As an average, regular person expected.
No, I don't think so. It's not. In fact, it's very interesting when Chazal described the great outstanding actions of great people. See, it's precisely because ordinary people aren't expected to do that that these people are called great when they do it. That's a view that they make all the time. But it's something to strive for, it's something to try to imitate, that qualifies them as great. So over here, when the Torah says that he committed adultery, you have to understand that on his level, what he did was equivalent to committing adultery. So that in terms of the Torah's expectations for him, these words are appropriate because they're being applied to him. Just like theft in Rav Safra's mouth, theft would apply to a person who changed his mind and didn't tell anybody that he changed his mind. And so it's not, again, it's not figurative use of the language. It's that in this context, taking into account the speaker and the one being described, it is it's a literal use of the language. Solomon. The Tanakh says that in Solomon's old age, he worshipped Anu. Say Chazal. Nothing like that ever happened. What happened was this. He had lots of wives. He married the daughters of foreign kings in order to cement alliances with them and in order to spread his influence, his wisdom. When he brought them to Jerusalem as his wives, he talked to the Torah, he talked about how to live as Jews, and they complied. Then he got old, able to supervise. So then they went back, some of them went back to their old ways, and they practiced idol worship in Yerushalayim. Because he didn't control them, or because he married them in the first place, when they worshipped idols, it's accounted to him as if he worshipped idols. Now, usually we say, listen, everybody's living his own life. Everybody's making his own decisions. If you commit a crime, it's not my fault. Why would I be described as committing your crime? Because you're not Solomon. You're talking about the king. And the king was wiser than all men who ever existed. If he didn't take care to prevent this, then it's going to be described that way because the sin in his case is equivalent to worshiping God. The way to describe it in the language that we have is worshiping idols. That for him is worshiping idols. Not that he could be tried in court and punished for it as an idol worshiper, just like Rosafra could not be, if he had taken the higher price, couldn't be tried in court as a thief. But he's saying that morally, in the case of this person, it's equivalent to that. Now, next time in Hashem, I'm going to broaden the discussion. The truth is that in every one of the cases that Bethesda mentions, there is evidence in the written Tanakh also that the low reading that Reuben committed adultery, that Solomon worshipped idols, that the low reading is not correct. It's not just that. Because we understand the standards of the Torah and the standards of these great people, that we understand on general grounds it shouldn't be right to think of them as committing the low crime, but understand that it's a description that the Torah is making for the particular application of these people. It's not just that. That itself is an important observation. But there's evidence within the verses themselves that taking it in the low meaning, as if it would be applied to your next door neighbor, is not correct. So that you have more than just a general philosophical position that these great people wouldn't commit these kinds of crimes and that the Torah writes on a high level. This one has to prove to us. He proved to us with examples the Torah writes on a high level. It's not just that, but there are other verses in each of the cases which indicate that you can't take it on the low level alone. And that means that his case is backed up even by what's in the explicit text itself, not just on the basis of this philosophical observation as to how the text should be understood. We'll pick that up next time.